short. While other team members had decorated their cubicles with photos of their families or maps of Mars or even computer printouts, Lee had taped an exquisite set of small silk paintings onto his walls. Mountains shrouded in mist, beautiful birds perched on a graceful tree limb, a pagoda by a lake. Touches of home. Even if he died in space, he reasoned, he wanted the comfort of those paintings beside him. But he did not so much as glance at them while he stared into the display screen that dominated his small desk. Waterman's broad, onyx-eyed face looked back at him, a face that could be very stubborn, Lee realized.
"I wish to give you as much latitude as possible," Lee said, "but adding 3 extra days to your traverse seems excessive to me."
He did not add that Voznesensky was not even supposed to be on this traverse. The Russians should have remained at the base camp, as the mission plan called for. He was already exceeding his directives.
"It's necessary," Waterman replied, "for geological reasons."
Lee almost let himself smile. Of course, for geological reasons. Naturally, Waterman would have a sound scientific reason for pushing the limits. A born troublemaker. Steepling his fingers in his lap, out of range of the comm unit's camera, Lee waited for the geologist's explanation. Waterman looked eager, black eyes wide and sparkling, lips slightly parted, energy fairly shining from his dark-skinned face.
"We've calculated the rover's fuel reserves, and they are more than sufficient to take us to the Tithonium region and back to the base, sir. Plus, a generous allowance for reserve."
Lee did smile, thinly. Waterman is thinking only of the technical side. To him, the political ramifications simply are not of importance. I wonder if he thinks of them at all.
"Dr. Lee, you understand the principles of geology."
And without hesitation, Waterman launched into a lecture about the rock formations on Mars. Lee listened with one ear, while another part of his mind felt amused at the scientist's earnestness and the unthinking arrogance of this enthusiastic young man lecturing his elder. The young fool simply does not understand that he is on terribly shaky ground politically. He honestly believes that science is all that matters. Lee wished he could live such an uncomplicated life, have such unhampered enthusiasms, pursue knowledge without worrying about those who control the purse strings and the honors. On the other hand, he reasoned as Jamie continued his nonstop recitation, suppose he kills himself down there. He will become a hero automatically and cease to be a problem. He would most likely be killing Voznesensky also, but that could not be helped. Lee shook himself when he realized where such thoughts were leading him. "My task," he said sternly to himself, "is to direct the exploration of Mars and allow the scientists to conduct that exploration with as little interference as possible. Waterman wants to go farther and faster than we have planned. The politicians will be angry if anything goes wrong." It took him a moment to realize that Waterman had finished speaking and was gazing expectantly at him from the display screen. Like a child asking his father for permission to take a new step toward adulthood, Lee thought. He blinked his eyes twice, then heard himself reply as if from some great distance.
"Go ahead with your plan. I will expect you, Commander Voznesensky, to call an immediate halt the instant you reach the critical point in your fuel supplies."
The camera down below swiveled back to Voznesensky.
"I have calculated the fuel reserves we need to get safely back to base and added a 20% emergency factor."
"When you reach that point, you must return, no matter where you are or what you are doing. Is that clearly understood?"
"Yes, sir."
"Dr. Waterman?"
He heard Waterman's voice reply.
"Clearly."
"Very well, then. Proceed."
Lee reached for the keyboard to end the transmission. He hesitated, though, long enough to add, "And good luck."
"Thank you."
The two men's voices rang back in unison. Earth. Kaliningrad. In the early days of the Soviet space program, when secrecy born of Cold War fears dominated everything, the locations of space facilities were kept as concealed as possible. The major Soviet launching base, for example, was said to be at Baikonur, a city in the middle of the Kazakh SSR, a land where Mongol hordes and the fierce horsemen of Tamerlane once rode. Actually, the launch center is near the town of Tyuratam, more than 300 kilometers southwest of Baikonur on the main rail line from Moscow to Tashkent. In those days of suspicion, there was no public mention of Kaliningrad, the mission control center from which the earliest manned space flights were directed. Gagarin's pioneering orbit of the Earth, the thousands of man-hours of flight aboard a dozen space stations, and finally the first expedition to Mars, all were directed from the center at Kaliningrad, about 6 kilometers northeast of the outermost circular motorway ringing metropolitan Moscow. The protocol for directing the Mars mission had been decided upon long before the various spacecraft had even begun to be assembled in Earth orbit. Knowing that there would be a communications lag of 10 minutes or more between Mars and Earth, the mission planners placed full authority in the hands of the expedition commander, Dr. Li Chengdu. There was no need for Dr. Li to check with mission command at Kaliningrad before making a decision. The day-to-day operations of the teams in orbit around Mars and on the planet's surface were his responsibility. That did not mean, however, that he could not be overruled. Having given his assent to Voznesensky and Waterman's unscheduled dash to Tithonium Chasma, Dr. Li routinely reported the change in the excursion plan back to Kaliningrad. Routinely, in this case, meant that he waited until the end of his day, as usual, before filing his report. The rover team's diversion to Tithonium was given as item number 17 of his customary daily report. 17 of 22. So it was slightly after 4 in the morning in Russia when his report arrived. The mission controllers worked 3 shifts, of course, but their directors, the men and women who made the real decisions, were soundly sleeping when Lee's report began scrolling on the display screen of the chief controller for this shift. He was a Russian who took his duties seriously. Sitting beside him at the console was his American counterpart, a perky, red-headed engineer on loan from Caltech's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Shoulder to shoulder, they read the report from the expedition commander on the display screen, the American woman slightly impatient with her colleague's slower pace at reading English. The mission control center was quiet and still at this hour. Even though all the stations were manned, there was little activity and less talk. Until the American controller suddenly exclaimed,
"He okayed it! Without checking with us?"
Eyes snapped wide and heads turned toward her. The Russian chief controller said, "Dr. Li is within his authority."
"The hell he is,"
said the American. Her green eyes were blazing fury.
"The protocol specifically states that any major change in the schedule must be cleared with mission control first."
"Major change," the Russian said mildly.
"You don't think a 600-kilometer diversion of that rover team is a major change?"
She yanked the telephone from its receptacle on the console and began pecking out a number.
"How much fuel does that buggy hold, anyway? Aren't they putting themselves in danger of getting stranded?"
The Russian tapped the console keyboard, and the specifications for the Mars rover displaced Dr. Li's report on the display screen.
"It has a cruising radius of 1,000 kilometers," he said. "More than half its mass is fuel, an enormous safety factor."
"Not if they're throwing in an unscheduled 1,200 kilometers, it isn't."
"You're calling the chief mission director at this hour?"
"Hell no, I'm not that crazy," the American answered, a slight grin breaking through her anger. "I'm calling Houston."
The Russian smiled back at her.
"Ah, and they will wake up the chief."
"Right. I may be quick-tempered, but I'm not stupid."
Houston. The chain of command on Earth was split, like everything else about the Mars mission, into 2 strands. While mission control was in Kaliningrad, there was a shadow mission control team at the old NASA Center at Clear Lake, near Houston. The center had been created in the early 1960s as a political plum for Texas. Originally designated the Manned Space Center and built nearly an hour's drive from downtown Houston, the center became the home of the astronauts, the place where all manned space activities were planned and directed. Eventually, it was named after Lyndon B. Johnson. As vice president, Johnson had chaired John F. Kennedy's Space Council and pushed vigorously for the daring program to land Americans on the moon within the decade of the 60s. But no matter how swiftly the engineers moved, the tides of history swirled faster. By the time the first astronaut set foot on the moon, Kennedy was dead and his successor, Johnson, out of office. The American space program, seemingly at the peak of success, was being gutted and virtually murdered, a victim of the Vietnam War that Johnson had escalated. Yet the Johnson Space Center remained and even grew.
As the hub of all manned space activities, it became headquarters for the hundreds of astronauts recruited to fly the space shuttle